Good morning, Nancy. Hi there.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi there, Nancy. It's Susan Peters. Hi.
And we have Rick Meyer as well.
And Rick Meyer as well.
Nancy, you're having audio issues? Yeah. Hold on just a second. Well, we're both in the office, so just one moment, please.
Okay.
We're having little audio difficulties on Nancy's end. We'll bear with us a second here. I think she's going to exit and then rejoin.
Olivia,
yeah.
if you choose to do so, I would love to share a screen briefly with you
sure.
this morning.
Yep.
But it occurred to me that I've logged on to my cell phone, and that's where you see the image and you're hearing my voice. But
okay.
to share the screen, I'd have to do it from my laptop. So I'm going to attempt, as we're waiting for Nancy to get on, to log
on
to my desktop.
I'm on, I think I solved the problem. Can you both
hear me?
You can
hear us. Yeah, we can hear you.
Yeah.
You can hear us?
Perfect. Yep.
Great.
Okay.
We're in business. Okay. So, why don't we just do a really brief introduction? Just so I know there's only four of us, but I'll just say I'm Olivia Brzee. I'm the coordinator for the technical services unit in our Division for Historic Preservation. Nancy.
Yes. Hi. Good morning. My name is Nancy Herder, and I'm the Technical Preservation Services Bureau Director.
Hi.
And, Susan, thanks.
Hi, I'm Susan Peters. I'm a longtime resident of the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and I'm the consulting party representing New Yorkers for Wired Tech in Manhattan Community Board 7.
And I am Rick Meyer. And I dialed in from Bethany Beach, Delaware. I was a long-time New York resident, a long time, 5 years, 1977 to 1982, and fell in love with Manhattan and Central Park, and that love affair continues. But I have been working with and learning a lot from Sue Peters, who is a consulting party on this one. I've been a consulting party on several other of the Link 5G applications, and we expect to be in the future, as well as with other communities around the country. So,
mm-hmm. Oh, that's good to know. Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Right, so we can go ahead and get started. Obviously, the subject of our call is the tower proposed at 741 Columbus Ave. And we struggled with that review, which is reflected in the fact that we did issue a few, differing opinions on it based on, additional information. But I'll just open up the floor to any questions or anything you want to start with.
Well, let me just start and introduce myself a little bit more and explain a little bit why I asked Rick for his help. I don't have a background in historic preservation, but my background is in the appreciation of history, especially New York history, since I've done research and publishing about the history of Wall Street and the banking sector of our city and how it affected the whole city and now the whole country and the world. But back then, it was affecting our city. And I gained from all of that research an increasing, very important understanding of the importance of keeping the accurate history so that people understand what's happening in the present and what they see in the present. So I just want people to realize that that has been my motivation. I didn't have experience with the laws, a historic preservation law, other of the NPA, and so I asked Rick for his help because he understands those laws and has more experience with them and their meaning. So that's why he's been helping me. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. That's helpful.
And and before we get into a couple of the questions, further background on this, I want to say thank you, Olivia, also to Sloan, who's not on the call, and Nancy, to you, to your entire team, because I know that you are spending a tremendous amount of time on this project. I know it's not your main mission, but I think you guys have been had this tossed at you, and you've done a fantastic job. I have worked with state historic preservation organizations in two other states, specifically West Virginia and Maryland, and I want to tell you, you guys are extremely professional on this, and you're doing a great job. And I, on behalf of Sue and myself, thank you very much.
Thank you for saying that.
And many, many other New Yorkers, I might add, who have been following this in various ways. Some have submitted comments. Some have just been acutely interested in it. It can be a very intimidating process in terms of its complexity and wrapping your arms around some of these issues. But we do appreciate all that you're doing that for us on that. So,
totally second what Rick said. Totally.
Thank you.
Thank you for that.
Well, and we heard as I think both of you were on the call with Mr. Sakota. We know that there's another batch of 30 coming. Mm-hmm. And I believe that is by no means going to be the largest batch. I think they are intending to roll out many, many more. Having read that contract with the City of New York and what they intend to do in terms of looking at some exhibits, so this is going to be going on for a while. And that's really why we wanted to talk to you today, because we're learning too, and we want to make sure we understand from your perspective. And can't say how much we appreciate you taking the time this morning to meet with us, so that as we develop comments in the future on future applications, that we really get our arms around what New York SHPO is considering and evaluating in these unique urban environments that these, particularly in Manhattan, but all over the five boroughs. Maybe not so much in the Bronx and Richmond County down to Staten Island, but certainly in the other areas, urbanized effects, to give an appreciation from how you guys were coming on this. I think I successfully logged in through my laptop, Olivia, but I can't tell on my phone. I turned my image off from the laptop. And
okay.
You guys are able to see my image on
We see you. We see you, yeah. Looks like we see you on your iPhone screen.
Yeah, that's my iPhone screen. So what we wanted to start with was to get to, we think, is a really salient point, and that was that you had asked for the raw images. And Nancy, in your final opinion on March 18th, you referenced the raw images as being kind of a deciding factor.
Mm-hmm.
But we wanted to make sure that we understood what those raw images were, and that we were all reading from the same sheet music, if you will. There was a file that was given to us of the raw images, which I think are 19 photographs.
Yeah, that's what we saw.
Yeah, and then there's also the report that the visual resource is an analysis that Sigma Technologies did, evaluation? Yeah. And I just wanted to compare those quickly, and I was going to share my screen
for
just a moment to see if we could show everybody that, and also pursue, I guess. So now to do that, what do I have to do here? I'm going to share the screen. No, your audio off. Sue, you were talking about your Let me see if I can find this here. Share screen. You can see me. Join now. This doesn't work, and we will.
Okay. I just am admitting you again.
Okay. You're letting me come back in. All right. And I'm going to cut this off so I'm not getting feedback. Is there still feedback?
No, you're good.
Okay.
There's some echo, actually.
Yeah, I can hear that.
You want to kill the first one that I logged in on the cell phone, but I think I've got two computer connections. Do I? Can I verify it? I'm not hearing it. Okay. All right, now you... No, I still get feedback. I'll turn that off. Tempter. Thought I had the microphone off. You know what? Let me just describe it, I guess, because I'm really sorry about this, but otherwise it's going to be that bad feedback. Let's turn that off.
No, we can't hear you.
I can hear. So. Oh, now I can't hear you. Okay, now you're muted.
All right,
we're good.
Slowly enough, Rick. We can still hear you through the.
Okay. So, if I could get your permission to share the screen.
I think you should be able to share.
There it is, share. Okay. Bingo. Select tab to share. Are you able to see anything?
We still see you.
Olivia, do you still have the balloon tests? And then when they,
I mean, do. Olivia, I have. I can pull it up if you tell me what to pull up, Rick. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Let's bag. You could kill my thing. Let me just walk you through it. So the two documents are the raw images, which I believe is a PDF.
It's not a PDF. It's this individual images, but
okay. And then I'm going to leave this one, but stay on my phone. All right. So you
okay.
should still have me that. So that should kill the background noise. And so if you bring up that, the Sigma Technologies report, and if you bring up the raw images, going to look at raw image 12. There's
sure.
19 of them. If you go to number 12, and I was going to look at image P12 in the report, just to make sure.
Okay. I'll navigate there, and then I'll share my screen. Image P12 in the report.
Yeah.
It's going to take me a few minutes to get there, seconds.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. Okay, I'm on image P12, and then raw image
12. Right.
And Rick, the raw image 12 is on page 12, right? in the document?
No, it's on page 19 of the report.
No, but I'm talking about the raw images.
Yes, it should be the 12th. It should be the in the sequence. It should be image 12.
Okay.
All right. You all see my screen?
Yes. There it is.
So then we have on the left here we have P12. And then on the right, we have the raw image 12.
Right. Okay, so what I just want to make sure is that, and we went back through those images pretty carefully, and we made sure they lined up, that they were the same images in the report. The report includes a couple of images at the very front where they have a picture of the measuring device and of the balloons and that sort of thing up close, just so that everybody could see what they were using. And then the rest of the photographs, the 19 images, are taken at various spots, which are identified in a map up in the beginning of the report. It's the ones in Central Park that we focused on, because I think that was kind of what was everybody's question was, what could we see from Central Park? There are no views toward Central Park per se, from windows and buildings around or whatever, but certainly from Central Park at street level, at pedestrian level, sort of trying to look to see what it, and it was number 12 that I think was the best indicative of this. This would be on the southeast corner of Central Park West and West 97th Street, and it is looking to the west. And in the report, it has a map in the lower left corner, a red arrow to kind of highlight the position of the balloons, and then it has an embedded box, which appear to be zoomed images on that. And that's in the report.
Yep.
And then the report itself, all of that, I mean, I'm sorry, in the raw images themselves, all of those are missing, right? The other thing that I wanted to just kind of quickly interject here while we have it is that there were only three balloons in the balloon test, and those balloons were only measuring the topmost height of what would be the proposed structure. And that had followed the instructions of SHPO on that. That's what you're seeing down there. So I'll stop for a minute, and I guess the question that we had is, what were you hoping, or what did you find in those raw images that was not in the Sigma Technologies report?
Well, I think the raw images allowed, once we saw the mock-up images, which we requested the mock-up, we received the report, and the report, you know, pinpoints exactly what the visibility is. And so in a way that kind of makes the it kind of gives an emphasis on the visibility. But with the raw images, without any, calling attention to the location and the visibility, I think it's actually a more accurate, representation of what you will actually see when you're on the ground. And I think that, this was like a really, as I said, a borderline case, and a very difficult determination for us to make. Nothing was different. It's only that in the report, the analysis, sort of calling out the visibility, it kind of made it seem more obvious.
I would agree with that. I think that was what they wanted to make sure that they were doing was that to visualize this. In the report itself, it's kind of unfortunate. The report itself, the folks from Sigma point out that they had used a lens, specific lens that had been chosen to try to replicate what the naked eye would see. And so you're able to see at 950 feet, because that's approximately the distance standing there on those cobblestones to the balloons, which are just on Columbus Avenue right there at the corner. It's a 950-foot shot, so it's a pretty good long one. The the map at the beginning, and maybe if you want to go back up there real quick, the map at the beginning, where's that map? Page 5 of the Sigma Technologies document.
I mean, page, yeah.
Yeah, that one right there. There's a cluster of dots in Central Park, and I wanted to just highlight those if I could for a minute, because I think this is really kind of key, is that of those dots, we, you know, all the different views on the street, we were focused on what could you see from Central Park, and what could you see from Central Park when there were no leaves on the trees. And as you can see, there's red dots and there's blue dots. And the red dots are all the points in Central Park at that particular spot, at that intersection of 97 and Central Park West, where you can actually see in. Most of those spots are on level ground, but spot number 15 is on a little hillock that's right there inside the wall of Central Park. But as you can see, from all of them are red, with the exception of the 5 that are blue. And we went and looked at those 5 blue ones, and 4 of those 5 are obstructed. In other words, they're either behind the wall, or they are, or there is new scaffolding on the what would that be on the
on the northwest corner.
But all the rest of them you have a view. So it really comes down to, then I've got the visibility. It comes down to, and I realize the hard call, it was minimal visibility, and then trying to define what minimal went was. In our last comments, and thank you very much for letting us submit them, we were very, very confused based on the string of communications we got from EBI on what we could and could not submit, but we submitted a batch of comments after your March 18th decision, thinking that we still had time, and you were gracious enough to take a look at them. In that set of comments, we enclosed a balloon test that, and I can't thank Sue enough for this, that Sue Peters did on her own, using a party supply store down on the Lower East Side. She had a string of balloons delivered, and we tried to map that out. And unfortunately, Mother Nature did not cooperate with us. And what we were trying to do with that balloon test was to measure the gap between the top of the roof, the one-story roof, and the top of what will be the pole. And there's going to be 13 feet that come across that.
13 feet?
Yes, 13 feet. It's a total of 32. We believe the roof is somewhere between 18 and 19 feet, and that's probably being generous, which is leaving at least 13 feet of a gap. And in our document, the last document that we sent you, there is a picture from almost the same spot.
Do you want me to pull that up?
Yes, please, if you could. If I could just
help
you do that.
Yes, let me, I'm going to stop sharing for a minute, and then I'll locate that.
That was our document that's, on that document that you got it. That would have been given to you as part of a transmittal on April 17th from Bolden, and there's amended comments from Landmarks West, and then there's also our comments. And,
So, Susan, you emailed that to us also on the 17th. Is that the same?
Yeah, and is it the same date? There's two documents. There's a set of comments from Landmarks West, Sean and his group, who did a fabulous job, and also our attachment, our document is attached to that. And way down on page, let's go to it here, way down on page 20 of that PDF or
okay.
page 14 of what we wrote,
yep.
20 or 14. There is a picture there if you want to share that.
Yep, I'm going to share it now.
Yeah. Yeah, so this came straight out of the Sigma Technologies report. They did not have windy days. They also had really nice warm days. As I said a minute ago, we had tremendously windy days. Sue and a doorman that she pressed into service were able to hold these balloons up and, or try to hold them up. But in this particular picture, the balloons are almost absolutely, totally vertical. And I took inserted a red line to show you the gap that is not being modeled, just so that you
right.
understand
yeah.
what that is. And then down in the picture on page, I can show you what the wind was doing
page
to
20,
us.
Page 20, I think. Page 20.
Yeah. Is it page 20? Yeah. Page
20. Oh, go up one, Olivia.
One more.
Okay. That's day three of the balloons, some of which we had to replace because we'd lost helium because we couldn't get them to stand up straight on day one and day two.
Yeah.
But it gives you an idea of what we were trying to model in terms of the white balloons and the gap that's visible above the blue.
Let me just say, I learned how to walk through the streets of Manhattan controlling 13 feet of helium balloons. And I don't know what people thought. No one really asked me any questions about
what were
no,
the
it's Manhattan. Of course they wouldn't ask you any questions.
They just get out of my way.
that dear Disney movie where the old man and the Boy Scout float their house away with a big pile of balloons, and that's what I was afraid was going to happen to you.
You have to be careful, especially on the first 2 days that were windy, because you lose control, and you don't want to hurt anybody, you know?
Yep.
It's, you're on the sidewalks. People are walking by, you know?
Anyway, on day three, it finally warmed up a little bit, and it finally got to the point where we could get at least somewhat vertical. It wasn't totally vertical, but on page 24, I wanted to make sure that you saw what we tried to model.
Oh. There's only...
Oh, I'm sorry, page 18. It would be 24 of the PDF. Page
18. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, and I could zoom on that. That is not a zoomed photograph. And I also want to point out that the lens aperture is not the same lens as what was being used by Sigma. So this is not the naked eye approximation that Sigma was getting. Theirs was a little bit more zoomed, right?
Okay.
Okay, but I want to make sure you understood what we were trying to convey in our document about eye of the beholder for minimal versus, you know, not minimal.
Yeah.
Is that there's a red brick building with dark windows that sits on the opposite corner of Columbus, right there. The tower, and it's in my remarks, I won't belabor too much in here, but in my remarks, tried to explain that the actual design that the PDC, which is it the Public
right.
Design
Public
Commission,
Design Commission, yeah,
approved. That design actually was made lighter to make it look translucent,
right?
Under the mistaken image that the translucence would
right.
would better approximate the sky. But in most cases, from the street, you're not looking up towards the sky; you're looking
right.
laterally, and so that
yeah.
translucence just makes it brighter, particularly when you have a dark windowed red brick building behind it. And you can see that right there. That's not a, you know, those balloons, which are a little bit whiter than what the translucent pole will be, but nonetheless, I think it gives you some ideas. So we were trying to model that because we were afraid that the balloon test only took those top three balloons as opposed to what you just saw a minute ago on the image that was above it, took a longer string of balloons. And model that, I guess that was on page 17. So that's what we attempted to try and show. Unfortunately, I think we were maybe a day later and dollar short in terms of being able to get those comments in. But it's a pretty massive tower, and it will definitely stick up above that that building. Anyway, so that's where the visibility side of it goes. The second set of questions that we have, and this really is looking at the future, because we want to make sure we understand this. Our friends from EBI tried from the very beginning to frame the discussion on the aspect of visibility to or from the resource. And we spent a tremendous amount of time in the three sets of documents, and Sue particularly very patiently on this, doing some research that also involved a tremendous amount of foot research, where we went and laboriously inventoried a batch of poles that we brought to your attention, and these were the Type M mast poles. If you go back to the SHPO report, it was actually SHPO, not EBI, but it was Sigma. If you go back to the Sigma report and you look at the picture on page, the picture T1, which would be on the Sigma report, what we brought to your attention was some street furniture, some very important street furniture that's been there since at least 1996. Yeah, next one down, that one right there. Okay, and there's two very important things there. There's underneath the red arrow, and again, this is talking about setting and feeling and association. The underneath the red arrow is a Type M mast pole, and it's green painted, and that particular pole is doing double duty. And you can't see it because of the map that's overlapping. You can see it, I think, as image number one of the raw images. Maybe that's a better way to say it. Go back to the raw images. Yeah, image number one of the raw images, because then you don't have the map in the way or whatever. That Type M mast pole, if I can just take a few minutes to describe that, is a historically accurate reproduction pole that is modeled after poles that were used in the 1890s, 1900s in New York. And it's doing dual duty now in that it has that arched arm over the intersection that's holding what is masked by the tree, perfectly masked by the tree, a set of traffic lights. And you can see in front of that, you can see the Link NYC kiosk, which is going to be replaced by the 30-foot tower, which will be taller than the Type M mast pole, and it will be much, much wider, particularly from that angle, than the Type M mast pole. In front of that is a Type B pedestrian pole, and that is only used in one area of New York City, and that is Central Park, believe it or not. But for reasons that we haven't been able to figure out, the Department of Transportation on Columbus, and only Columbus, has brought out a collection of those Type B pedestrian poles. That's the black pole with the ornamental top on it. And those run up and down Columbus on both sides of the street. And on this intersection, there are, correct me, Sue, but I think there are four of them in total. And then down the street, every block heading south, there are more of them. But those Type M mast poles, just to give you the history on those, were installed in 1996 when the city of New York undertook what at the time was a massive redevelopment project to kind of clean up and restore Columbus Avenue. And it is the only avenue on the west side where they have introduced those decorative poles. And they go from approximately 68th Street all the way up to 110th. And so this would be right in the middle of it. Also, because 97th is a cross street through Central Park, there are those Type M's going both to the right, which would be to the east, and to the left, to the west at that particular intersection. So they're very prevalent. And they do add to the color and, you know, complexion of that streetscape. Which, with all that background, why is that important? Because, again, what the the Department of Transportation, in our opinion, was trying to do was to extend out this association, this feeling of this connectivity to Central Park, in not only through the vegetation, which are is very prevalent on Columbus, but also because of the placement of these poles. And you can't find them really anywhere else. There have been some neighborhoods that have put in Bishop's Crooks, where there's been block associations that have funded the poles with their own money, and there have been a few of them that have purchased these Type Bs, but the Type Bs, for the most part, are pretty rare, very rare, although you go into Central Park, you can find lots and lots of them, and they're up and down Columbus. So what we were arguing in our comments was that this design of a pole on this particular block was going to interrupt that setting, which we believe had been produced. And I know that in the visibility analysis, if you're just looking at the visibility as the sole criteria, but we had provided all this other additional research on the history of those poles. There's even a photograph in our report down on, sorry to have you keep jumping back and forth, but on our report, it would be the SHPO. On page, I think it's like page, the very last page of our report, if we could take you to it, that has a historical image.
The very last page?
Yeah, of our report.
This one?
Yes, that's the East River Savings Bank. And is that on 96th and?
Northeast corner of 96th and Amsterdam.
At Amsterdam, yeah, okay. That, you can see in that picture, the Type M mast pole. And if I could just give you one more small piece of history and then I'll stop talking about it. For many, many years, there was an elevated rail line that ran up the entire length of Columbus Avenue, from 59th Street, where it made a curve at southern part of Central Park, and then ran up Columbus Avenue from 59th all the way to, I think, 110th or 120th or something, and then it made another turn. And those elevated tracks took up so much of the width, and they covered not only the streets but the sidewalks. They were massive, and they blocked out all the sun, and they were just loud, clanky things. They were taken down at the very end of the 1930s, early, like I think they were finished in 1941, and that steel was sold to Japan. That Japan used a lot of that steel to build battleships, believe it or not. We didn't know it at the time, but that's what the history of it was. Anyway, those tracks were taken down, and up till that point, the only type of street lighting that was on Columbus were Bishop Crooks poles. And the Bishop Crooks poles were used because they were very narrow designs. If you know what a Bishop's Crook is, they have I guess they go about 3 feet out. Light fixture hangs down off of it. There are a few Bishop's Crooks still scattered about on the side streets, but they were all taken down over time, unfortunately, on the Upper West Side. They're still downtown and some other areas. When they reintroduced the historically accurate poles in 1996, the decision was Bishop Crooks are Type M mast poles. And since they no longer had the tracks and they had this open sky, they used the Type Ms, such as you see there, that have been previously over on Amsterdam. But unfortunately, those have all disappeared. There are no more of those on Amsterdam. So I mentioned that Sue had gone up and down and inventoried all these. We attached those to one of our earlier documents, a handwritten map that showed where all these different poles were. But the reason with all that background is being given is that we had tried to explain the connectivity of the setting to the other resource, which is really in discussion here. And that other resource was the Central Park West, Upper West Side Historic District, which is actually the resources that are closest to this particular intersection is on West 96th Street between Central Park and Columbus. There are some listed buildings that are not yet on the historic register, they are eligible for the historic register, that are in the landmark district on West 96th. And it was the landmark district report that we pulled the material out that explained the very deep historical connections between Columbus and the Upper West Side, Central Park West landmark district. So, and it was that setting and the interruption of that setting that we were really afraid of. The folks from EBI were very focused on visibility, and I think SHPA was, on the visibility to and from Central Park, but it was this other resource, the Central Park West, Upper West Side Historic District, Landmark District, that we were focused on when it came down to this, also this question of setting and how that had affected the neighborhoods in there.
Yeah.
Why I'm asking all this is we're trying to figure out going forward in the future, is that a proper thing for us to be doing? Should we be focusing on setting, or should we only be focusing on visibility?
Both.
Can I add something?
I just stopped sharing. Go ahead.
Yeah. I just want to add something before you answer that question. You know, I live on the corner of 98th and Broadway. I'm right next to the huge Riverside Park Historic District, which I ride my bike through every morning to the park. But when I do my shopping, you know, I walk out of my door and the corner there is Broadway. And suddenly I'm in the commercial district that I need to use because I walk to buy things. And when I'm over at Central Park West in the historic district there, if you live in a historic district like Central Park West, you walk out of your door and you need to buy groceries or you need to go to the drugstore or whatever, the only available resource is to walk to Columbus Avenue. It's part of your life. And so I just want to say that's my experience in New York and very important to people in New York. Thank you.
Yeah, and thank you for going through the work you did to prepare those reports. We did review everything you submitted. We do very, very much appreciate the work that all the consulting parties are doing, including yourselves, and it does, you know, make our jobs easier. And we do consider all the consulting party comments. To try to answer your question, the work that you're doing is absolutely valuable, and we do look at it, and it does help us in our decision making. And we do definitely consider setting as well as visibility. And I will explain a little bit about the Central Park, eligible resource. It's a National Historic Landmark, which is the highest level of status in terms of historic resources in the way we have things set up in our country. And so it does have a higher level of protection, a higher level of significance. So that was very much informing our analysis of this particular proposed location at 741 Columbus. And and for Central Park, it is about the setting of the park. When we consider in other areas of the city, visibility of proposed 5G poles from historic districts, we are also considering the setting of those historic districts and the boundary of those historic districts. So I think the one at 741 Columbus, initially it had been represented as not visible from Central Park. We then based on comments from consulting parties, including you all, we asked to take a second look, and we asked for, verification of that. And the information that was submitted by EBI demonstrated that the initial viewshed mapping had been inaccurate. And so we then, once we understood that there was visibility, we felt that it could be be adverse. So we issue that opinion. Given, again, the National Historic Landmark status of Central Park and wanting to be very protective of that, once there was, additional analysis and the actual physical mock-up, that really, made it hard for us to continue to have the opinion that it was adverse based on how minimal the visibility will be. So it isn't just, visibility alone as a threshold, it is the amount of visibility. And so, your report and the, EBI mock-up showed that, the top portion of the pole will be visible, but we, at the end of the day, felt that it was at such a great distance that it would be really hard to make the argument that it would significantly diminish the historic characteristics for which Central Park is a National Historic Landmark. So we do have to, carefully consider the language of the regulations for, that we are operating under here. And, we felt that, yes, it's visible. It doesn't look great. That's not, it's not entirely appropriate, but we didn't feel that it rose to the level of adverse and that it would, substantially impair an enjoyment of the setting of Central Park. And I will say also, you make a good argument for what you went into at the second portion, Rick, where you talked about the existing eligible historic districts and the lampposts and the corridor, transportation corridors. But we are constrained by, ability to look at only eligible resources existing, so things that have already been determined eligible for the National Register, and we don't have jurisdiction over the reproduction historic lampposts. The only instance where we would have jurisdiction would be for an actual locally designated landmark, NYC landmark lamppost. So we, because the, nearby historic district is not a National Historic Landmark, we felt that the, whatever visibility there might be of that pole on Columbus Ave was not going to rise to the level of an adverse effect there either. So, that's kind of how we, worked through this particular one. We maintain that it's inappropriate to install them inside within the boundaries of existing historic districts, and we do very much carefully consider the immediate context in terms of adjacency to individually eligible resources and the surrounding scale.
Thank you. That's actually very helpful. I was taking a lot of notes as you were talking. I appreciate that because, again, I think that I know that EBI is learning as well. EBI and Bolden are learning as well. And I think you're going to find we're going to see a lot more of the applications come in right on these margins, right on the on the visual lines where they will work very hard to say that there cannot be an adverse effect because it's not, abutting or directly in the front door or front line of one of these resources. And we're going to have to adjust our narratives and analysis as well, because I think we can anticipate that going forward, that, what is the setting and how do you define it in an urban environment, where you have these things that are blocking, right, views, direct views sometimes.
And we're, like Olivia said, constrained by the existing regulations, and so there is a 2004 nationwide programmatic agreement for cell towers that are office has signed on to. And in that agreement, it says that a property has to already be eligible or listed at the time of the project. So we cannot look and identify additional properties. And that's as per that 2004 nationwide programmatic. and they're using that programmatic for the Link 5G project or projects. So, and I really think, I mean, we've talked about it internally, the 2004 nationwide programmatic could not have contemplated what is happening with Link 5G, meaning there's a concentration of towers within an urban setting. And so I don't, we're really struggling within the confines of that 2004 agreement. And like Olivia said, we have to make sure that our opinions are supported by that agreement.
I will also add about the characteristics of a particular setting that Central Park is a scenic landmark, and obviously, you know, that's very much part of why it's a National Historic Landmark, is because of the pastoral urban, or the urban park landscape design. So that scenic quality, which is a different consideration than an urban historic district, where the setting there is, very much like a densely built environment. So we do treat scenic resources a little bit differently in terms of the potential impacts of these poles.
Well, and thank you for that. And to both of you, Nancy, also to your comments, I could not agree more. I think that the technology in 2004 was almost exclusively limited to lattice and giant monopole structures, steel lattice and monopole structures. And as these antennas have become smaller and smaller and smaller, as the radios have become smaller and smaller, the packaging, not only the power, but the packaging of these devices is allowing them to go on street level configurations like this. And I agree with you. I don't think the 2004 National Programmatic, the NPA, anticipates this or even could have anticipated it, which is unfortunate, because I think we're going to see this technology continue to change and to morph over time. But for right now, how do we come up with an understanding of what you guys are dealing with, so that we can produce the research and the analysis to try to help convey our concerns and be able to come up to the right balance on these things. I appreciate that very, very much. That sums it up pretty nicely. How do you, what is the constraints in your urban environment? When it comes down to the light poles, this is where the frustration that I believe I share with Sue on this, is that it took so much to get the city of New York to put those poles out there.
Yeah.
So much. And to add this visual appearance, and by the way, you may be aware that there are Bishop's Crooks in other parts of the city where they strap the backpacks on because it's existing.
Oh, wow.
So it's a different set of criteria.
They might not have to come in for review, maybe.
Yeah, they don't have to come in. And the city's been more than happy to do it without any regard. In its right hand, left hand, you've got the Department of Transportation.
Right.
Going to all this trouble to come up with these, historically accurate reproduction lamps.
Right.
You've got, somebody else slapping these stuff on backpacks or whatever else. But on these, we want the city of New York to continue to upgrade these lamps
and to spend the extra money when they do these redevelopments to get these, look and feel, because it's so important to these communities. So we're trying to figure out how to. And then this kind of a tower comes in, and like, wow, what do we do? Because it's so out of character with everything else in the city.
We're really hoping that there can be mitigation in the form of a redesign. That would be, the best outcome in terms of mitigating these, that we can, that we would, recommend. We don't know how realistic that is, but.
And I express an opinion that I think is pretty fairly widely held with the groups that are working on this. You heard Mr. Sakota say himself that there are only two of all of these 130 to 170, I can't remember what the exact number was. Only two of them have actually been energized with
have been activated for 5G,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, for 5G.
Yeah, I heard that. I heard that.
The rest of them are all speculative.
Quite shocking,
and,
yeah.
They have not been able to do it. And the convention that I hold on this is that the technology is, in fact, morphing so fast that these wireless providers don't need what was designed actually now almost 4 years ago.
Right.
They just don't need it, and they have not jumped on the opportunity, even though many of these are now operational and up and built. So that gives you an idea, to your point, Nancy, that the technology is continuing to morph, and these guys are building a solution for which nobody has a need at the moment. So we're working on that. Sue, those are the questions that I had. Do you have any others?
No, I'm absorbing everybody's thoughts. It's quite an in-depth discussion, and I really appreciate it. Thank you very much for sharing.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
Well, actually, I do have one more question, and that
sure.
is that when you folks are making, and thank you very much for this, you have made a number of adverse effect determinations, and some of those are very important. Two of them that I worked on, Olivia, I don't know if it was you or Sloan that signed these, but two of them that I worked on in Chinatown. One of them is at, I believe the right number here is 94 Bayard.
I remember I did review that.
Mulberry and Bayard.
Yeah.
And that one was actually in the historic district where there are historic resources on all four corners, right?
Right.
And you gave the adverse, but I don't see any action. I think they say it's being mitigated, but has Bolton been giving you timelines for some of this stuff?
No.
No. Slated for mitigation, yeah.
No. There's been not sufficient communication from EBI about what is happening with many of the polls where we, you know, issued an opinion that may be adverse. So we don't know it sounds like a lot of those are just being withdrawn or, alternate locations are being considered. And if an alternate location is selected, then it will come forward as a totally new project and totally new Section 106 consultation and review.
Yeah, we also are aware that there are several polls down in the lower west side.
Yeah, the West Village.
West Village, Gaithersburg, where Bolden is going straight to the FCC.
Yeah, and that we're reaching out to the FCC to try to get more information on how that process should play out. For the advert to 100 Jane Street, 100 Horatio Street, the adverse effect findings we made. So we do not have a lot of clarity.
I don't think anybody does. I don't think it's really been tested much. I don't think there's much. I don't think there's much in the way of. There's certainly not much case law on it, I don't think it's had to have these kind of scenarios before. But okay.
Yeah, and I'll. Well, If there is going to be, like, the FCC agrees that it is adverse and they're going to permit the project or license the project, there will be a memorandum of agreement. And so you will know at the point in time when all the agencies have weighed in, and if the project is still going to move forward as planned, again, you will be looking out for a memorandum of agreement. So it's a good marker of where we're at in the process. But ultimately, it's up to the FCC about whether it's adverse or not, or whether they're going to request minimization or avoidance. I mean, the SHPO is always making recommendations to federal agencies.
And you're saying, but it's up to the FCC as the final decider on this stuff.
That's correct.
Do you believe, or have you been counseled by perhaps New York's state lawyers on this, that the American Council for Historic Preservation has to be consulted too on something like that? In other words, ignoring you or disregarding or contesting what you've done and taking it to the FCC. Is the AHCP, I got that right?
ACHP, Advisory Council. On, they have not been invited to consult on any of these, as far as we know, and it would be, I believe it would be the FCC that would need to, actually the NPA says it's the applicant, so it would be Bolden who would need to invite the ACHP to comment, to consult and comment. And I think the NPA says that step happens once there's an adverse effect finding, but when the parties can't agree on mitigation. So we haven't even gotten to that point yet, because it's our understanding that Bolden is still trying to argue that there's no adverse effects anywhere for any of these.
Right.
That's the gist of it, yeah. So we haven't even gotten to that point where the applicant might need to bring in and invite the ACHP to consult. And even at the end of the day, the role of the ACHP is kind of like a mediator, but ultimately gives deference to the findings of the FCC. It's a process that has quite a lot of limitations on it in terms of protecting historic resources.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we agree with you. I certainly agree with you, and I think some others that are working on the Gainas Board polls agree very much so that these procedures at this point are extremely confusing.
Yep.
And remembering that the wireless industry wrote those rules for the most part, it gets very confusing as to what the powers are of the respective parties to participate in this. The role of the consulting parties, the role of ACHP, mm-hmm. And ultimately of the FCC. I personally don't think the FCC wants to be in the position of overruling state historic preservation offices when it comes to determinations of adverse effect. I don't think they want to be in that spot. I don't think they want every wireless tower builder to come running to them as soon as they get an adverse opinion from the multitude of state historic preservation offices that they have to deal with. It won't work out. So. But that's a personal opinion. Anyway, we've taken an hour plus of your time, and it's been wonderful. I'm sorry about the technical detail.
That's okay. We worked it out.
Technically savvy to share screens and show us all these pictures and forthcoming on your explanations on this. It really has been very, very, very helpful. We look forward to working with you and your team in the future. This has been a delight, and we, again, can't stress enough how we appreciate all the effort that you're and the thoughtfulness that you're putting into this, because I think
it's
not
special. I want to just double say that, because cooperativeness is so generous. Thank you so much, because your time is so precious.
Well, yeah. Thank you. I appreciate you saying that.
Thank you for that, because sometimes it does get kind of demoralizing, you know. So we appreciate that.
We very much appreciate that, yeah.
Good to see you. Girls laugh.
Well, we know everybody shares the same goal, and that is trying to do our very best in protecting these resources, but we're all constrained by the rules that are written by others. We have to try and figure out how to navigate them as effectively as possible. So thank you.
Yes.
Well, you guys are
well said. Okay. Well said. Okay. Well, nice to meet you both.
Great. Nice to meet you both.
For, thank you for all your hard work.
Talk to you soon.
Okay.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye. Yes. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Soon.
Bye.